that is the biggest fight we have. It's a fight of a generation, and it's upon all of us to do whatever we can to make that happen.
We don't want to be evil. We don't want to work for a company that's doing evil.
Wanting to kind of hold someone's hand, look them in the eye, and assure them that I'm here to listen to them for an hour and a half, talk about their life and make sure that they know that their life and their story matters, that their story deserves to be told, and that they're not alone in this world.
And so I found that my way in was to get people's shoulders down from their ears and relax them into who I was by sharing my story and making it funny.
In this horrible world where human beings are stripped of all that is human, I will never compromise with any iniquity. I will not remain silent before any injustice, but pay heed and work to rectify it.
Hey, welcome to the Labor Radio Podcast, weekly our roundup of highlights from some of the more than 100 shows that make up the Labor Radio Podcast Network. On today's show, New York State AFL-CIO Chief of Staff Ryan Delgado talks about why the PRO Act is so important for working people. Workers at Google are forming the Alphabet Workers Union. How can media be used as an organizing tool? Plus, visits with Alexandra Gray and Ian Harvey, two performers who have overcome prejudice and risen to prominence while raising awareness of the trans community. And Jeonte Il and Lee So-sun, two South Korean garment worker organizers. We've got reports today from Union Strong, the Heartland Labor Forum, the Valley Labor Report, the SAG-AFTRA podcast, and Working Class History. I'm Chris Scarlock for the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly. Here's the show.
For the New York State AFL-CIO, I'm Darcy Wells, and this is Union Strong.
A growing number of Americans say they want to join a union. According to a recent Gallup poll, union approval stands at 65%, one of the highest marks in half a century. Research from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology shows more than 60 million people would vote to join a union today if given the opportunity. Workers in America favor unions, and tens of millions want to join one. So what's stopping them? Outdated labor laws, which is why on this podcast, we're going to take a deep dive into a generational opportunity that is on our doorstep. Passing the Protecting the Right to Organize Act, also known as the PRO Act. Joining me to talk about what the PRO Act is, why it's so important to working people, and the opportunity to get it passed is the Chief of Staff for the New York State AFL-CIO, Ryan Delgado. Ryan, thank you for joining me today.
Thanks, Darcy. It's my pleasure.
So I started by saying that the numbers of people supporting unions and wanting to join unions is way up. And I pointed out that outdated labor laws is one of the roadblocks to making that happen. So can you start by talking about that? Why is it sometimes so hard for workers to unionize?
Darcy, when you hear the statistics that you laid out in the opening, I think the natural question would be, how does a union organizing drive ever fail? In reality, the question is, how does a union organizing drive ever succeed? The playing field is just so overwhelmingly tilted towards employers who really can go to any length to try to thwart their workers from exercising their rights, from hiring union avoidance firms who specialize in silencing workers, holding captive audience meetings where they force workers to listen to anti-union propaganda. In some of the worst cases, they'll go so far as to fire union supporters, which you can only imagine the chilling effect that has on workers who are trying to stand up and organize. You know, but even when employers are found to have broken the law under the current system, the penalties are so insufficient and justice is often so delayed, the damage that's done can't be recovered from. So that's really what workers who are trying to raise their voices together as one and organize face in organizing drives.
So these companies and corporations, they really have nothing to lose. They can just go up against it. If they don't want their workplace to be organized, then if they're not really facing any kind of fines or any deterrent, I can see there would be no disincentive for them to try to stop it.
That's right. We often hear on rallies and picket lines and different mobilizations, justice delayed is justice denied. And that's really the same effect when you have penalties that are issued so late. The damage is done at that point already.
So does the fate of the PRO Act depend on whether the Senate eliminates or changes the rules of the filibuster? Because the House has passed this, what, twice now?
That's correct. The House passed it in last Congress, and they just passed it last month in this Congress. And in New York, we saw that all 19 Democrats in our delegation co-sponsored the bill and voted for it. And we should point out that John Katko, a Republican from New York, was one of only five in the country to vote in favor of it, and as he did in the last Congress as well. We had strong support here in New York, and it was also a strong vote in the House. But yes, you're right. Now it turns to the Senate, and we have to do all we can to make sure that our senators are supportive. Certainly in New York, Senator Gillibrand and Senator Schumer have been strong advocates for the bill and calling for its passage. And we need to work with our partners across the country to make sure we can replicate that strong support elsewhere. One thing that we have that's really something going for us this time is a president who is leading the fight for this bill. He has been a breath of fresh air in terms of the way he speaks about unions and his support for unions and policy.
When we're talking about the Senate, our senators, Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and Senator Gillibrand, are on board with passing the PRO Act. And we should not, you know, feel discouraged with what we're facing in the Senate, right? Because when you take a look even at the elections, look what happened in Georgia. People were very surprised at that outcome.
That's right, Darcy. You know, the labor movement has never shied away from the tough fight. And when we put our mind to it and our full muscle and effort, we can accomplish anything. We're coming upon Workers' Memorial Day later this month, which commemorates the passage of the Occupational Safety and Health Act, OSHA. And those fights are not easy. They're never easy. But the impact they have on workers' lives make them more than worth the fight. And in fact, this year, Workers' Memorial Day is really the kickoff to our PRO Act mobilizations across the country. And that is the biggest fight we have. It's a fight of a generation. And it's upon all of us to do whatever we can to make that happen. Because just what OSHA showed us, safety and health is inextricably linked to unions and organizing. And that's why we're bringing those two concepts together this year, because how many more workers' deaths can be prevented if more workers are represented by unions? They go hand in hand, and that's really our focus this year and everything we do.
All right, Ryan Delgado, thank you for being my guest today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks again, Darcy.
Good evening, and welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm your host, Michael Savoie. Our show tonight is titled Organizing Google, the Alphabet Workers Union. My guest is Andrew Gaynor DeWar, AWU Press Coordinator. Good evening, Andy. How are you?
Hey there. Doing well. Thank you.
Everyone is familiar with Google, Andy, but no one knows who Alphabet is. Can you tell our listeners about Alphabet?
Sure. So a few years back, Google was restructured as a corporation to set up this umbrella holding company called Alphabet. So Alphabet is the company you own stock in if you buy shares. Alphabet owns Google and owns a few other smaller companies. There's Waymo, which makes robot cars. There's Loon, which does balloons that provide cellular internet. There's a few other small companies.
Okay. So then the Alphabet Workers Union.
Yes. So we're open to anyone who works for any Alphabet company, Google, Waymo, Verily, which does life sciences stuff. And that's anyone who is a direct employee of those companies or works for a vendor or contractor. So it's anyone who works for Alphabet, not just anyone directly employed by Alphabet.
Okie doke. That would be vendors, contractors, temps, things of
sure,
that
nature. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Generally, those are excluded from a bargaining agreement. But you're not seeking a bargaining agreement. You're seeking to engage everyone in a unit, but without necessarily a contract. Explain how that would work.
Yeah, so we're taking a bit of a different approach here. So Alphabet's an enormous company, right? There's more than 100,000 people who work for Alphabet in the US, some of those as direct employees, some of them as vendors or contractors or temps, as you said. And with the traditional bargaining unit and NLRB election approach, you typically pick one workplace or one group of workers, you hold an election, you get people to sign cards, and that leads, if you win, to the contract bargaining process that a lot of unions go for. For the size and scale of Alphabet and the complex corporate structure that Alphabet uses to split up the workforce, that didn't really make sense for us as an initial strategy. So instead, we're focused on all the other things that unions can do. We provide member services like legal services. We have organizer trainings. We can run campaigns. So we're able to build each other up in solidarity and exercise worker power through all the same avenues that every other union has, but we're not currently seeking an NLRB election or a contract just as a tactical decision. That doesn't really make sense for us right now.
Okay, that makes sense to me. And of course, I would be quick to agree that concept of organizing is dated. So we certainly need a new concept. So the values of U.S. corporations are hard to find, man. They're often written somewhere, Andy, and then they bury them where they'll never be found again. And certainly not in their actions or behavior. But Google was founded with a do no harm principle.
Yeah,
does that still exist, or is that buried under that rock somewhere?
Oh, yeah, that's exactly what's happened to it. So, yeah, Google's motto famously in its early days was don't be evil. And that still, I think, really resonates with workers and means a lot. We don't want to be evil. We don't want to work for a company that's doing evil. But the significance of that motto to corporate decision making has certainly faded over time. And as a symptom of that, it's not the motto anymore. It gradually was pulled back and moved deeper and deeper into documents that were harder and harder to find and finally removed altogether, and they disappeared it. At the Alphabet Workers Union, we still believe in that. We still think that don't be evil is a really important principle for a company as powerful and wide-ranging as Alphabet, one that builds technologies that power everything from email to social media to videos, right? YouTube is such an important part of our political and social lives. And don't be evil is a really important guiding principle, and it's one that we still stand by, even if the bosses have dropped it by the roadside.
Tell me, how would you, as a startup, how would you be able to leverage? Sounds like you've had some immediate success already, of course, perhaps because it was more than an individual filing, and you had maybe the direction of the CWA, which I understand has been a big part, we'll talk about that later, of your organizing effort. But how do you leverage your negotiation with companies?
Yeah, so worker organizing at Google has a long and storied history, right? We're by no means the first workers at Google or at Alphabet to stand up for what we thought was right in terms of treatment of workers and also in terms of broader ethical issues. So a few years back, there was the women's walkout where something like 20,000 Google employees walked off the job to protest Google's handling of sexual harassment allegations and forced arbitration clauses in employment contracts. There have been petition drives and employee resistance movements around engagements with the U.S. Customs and Border Patrol Agency, with the Department of Defense, with the government of China. So there's this long history of organizing and a really rich history of strategies and tactics that workers have employed.
I must say that your action is quite reminiscent of the 1900s IWW movement and certainly wish you all the success in the world, and I think you could possibly be an inspiration, the much-needed inspiration, to the entire labor movement, man. So
we hope so.
Good luck, and with that, let me say thank you for sharing your activity with the Heartland Labor Forum tonight.
Solidarity forever! Solidarity forever!
Tennessee Valley, this is the Valley Labor Report. My name is Jacob Morrison, here with my co-host and fellow agitator, David Story. Today, we are talking to Dr. Maximilian Alvarez, host of the Working People podcast and editor-in-chief of the Real News Network. Dr. Max, thank you very much for taking the time to join us this morning.
Of course, brothers. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, David reminded me that you had successfully defended your dissertation. I had forgotten all about that. So that's got to feel really nice.
It does. I mean, it's weird to kind of think back of all that's on all that's happened this year in pandemic conditions. But I've been, technically out of graduate school for a number of years, but I hadn't ever really fully finished my dissertation to get my doctorate, you know, because I started working out here in the D.C. and Baltimore area. And so the clock, you know, finally ran out, and I had to either meet that deadline or not get that piece of paper. And so thankfully, this past summer, while juggling the podcast and my full-time job and living through a pandemic, I managed to get my doctorate. So thanks, guys.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's really cool. What was your dissertation on, if you don't mind?
I looked at kind of anarchist Mexican political groups and communist Mexican political groups on either side of the Mexican Revolution, and wanted to think about, you know, not just how they used the media that was available to them at the time, right? Newspapers and, you know, distributing those newspapers through the post office and yada, yada, yada. But how the changes in the media technologies of the 20th century actually shaped the ways that they organized, right? And shaped the ways that they thought they could achieve their political goals and the things that they did with media. So, you know, I think it's relevant to what we're doing here. So, but it's basically in a nutshell, like the relationship between media and how we use it and how that affects kind of the ways that we engage in politics.
And so, you know, Max, I'm interested in how do you feel like media can be used as an organizing tool, as a media person?
I think that in a lot of ways, my own kind of desire to use media in a way that is useful to working people, right? And to offer media as something that can be an organizing tool, that can be a tool for building solidarity amongst working people, not only in the United States, but internationally, to have those human moments, right? To really kind of listen to people, right? And to genuinely communicate that listening is not conditional, right? I'm not here to sit and listen to your story only so long as you say the right thing, right? Or you give me what I'm looking for. I really just, you know, in a lot of ways, imagine myself as kind of sitting at this table in this fast-paced kind of digital world, wanting to kind of hold someone's hand, look them in the eye, and assure them that I'm here to listen to them for an hour and a half, talk about their life and make sure that they know that their life and their story matters, that their story deserves to be told, and that they're not alone in this world.
Max, we've got just a minute or two left.
Thanks so much for coming on, Max. I mean, really, really
thank
you.
Yeah, we appreciate it.
Like I said, honored to be here, guys, and I love and appreciate all the work that you have been doing. And since we've got about a minute left, I just wanted to embarrass David and really kind of stress again what a gift this show has been, how amazing it's been to see David, a fourth generation Alabaman Unionist, bring Jacob kind of like under his wing and to see that dynamic unfold. And now that David's going back to organizing, right, the show with his imprint is going to live on. And I think that it has impacted the rest of us in this kind of labor media, left media, whatever you want to call it, realm. And one thing that I wanted to kind of say about that, that ties it to everything we're talking about with miners at Warrior Met Coal, is when I was driving 14 hours from Baltimore to Bessemer and I crossed the state lines and I made it into Alabama, I was listening to your guys' show on the Amazon Union Drive. I was listening to David talk to Big Mike about things like honor and dignity and humanity. And I hope, if nothing else, anyone listening and anyone involved in media understands, like we're talking about here with this Warrior Met Coal, that you need to address those issues to build solidarity among working people.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gabrielle Carteris, president of SAG-AFTRA. And I'm David White, National Executive Director of SAG-AFTRA.
On this episode, we are actually delighted to feature two of the most successful trans performers working today. We have Alexandra Gray and Ian Harvey. Both of these actors have broken barriers and risen to prominence while raising awareness of the trans community worldwide.
Alexandra, I know you came from Chicago. Let's go in a little bit to your backstory.
Oh, sure. Yeah, well, I came on Southwest Airlines. Yeah, this is my 10-year anniversary being in LA. My family had disowned me after I transitioned, so I was very newly trans. And it was cold in Chicago. I was kind of homeless in Chicago. And somebody made a joke and said, well, you're really funny. You should be an actor and you should just go to California. And at that point, I had nothing to lose. You know, I had lost everything. So I just bought a plane ticket and a one-way plane ticket for $60. Wow. And the plane was so empty. I mean, there was maybe six of us on that plane. And I just remember it was like just the most terrifying thing. I was like, what am I doing? And so I came to LA and I was homeless. I lived in a shelter, the LGBT Center in Hollywood. And I lived there for 3 months and got into a transitional living program for 2 years. And during that time, I really hit the pavement hard. I was doing background work. I was doing lots of extra work and audience work. And while I was homeless, and I got myself back into college and I went to CSUN and study theater. And finally, I think the first 5 years of my journey into this career was survival. You know, I was trying to survive. I mean, I was trans. I had to think about healthcare. I had to think about all this stuff, you know. So after the 5 years and finally being able to get a job where I wasn't fired for being trans, you know, I was able to finally get my own place. And then once I got established in that way, it was like, okay, now I can really go even further and try to really go after this career. And it just so happened in that sixth year, you know, Laverne Cox was kind of just popping all over the scene, you know? And so I was just in the right time. And, you know, 2016 was a really great year for me. And there's definitely been some hard journeys along the way, but, you know, we're making some progress. But that's a little bit of my journey, and not so much as one phone call in 10 years from my family. So, but that's okay, because I've established a new life for myself, and one that I can be proud of and that I'm happy, and I wouldn't regret anything.
Alexandra, just the language that you just use is inspiring on a level for people who are out there trying to figure themselves out on a number of dimensions, not just gender. Because every experience that you discuss, you refer to that as something that you would not change and something that has made you stronger. Ian, you too have said that your transformation on stage, how was that? And did that have any negative implications, positive or?
I have a sort of personal philosophy that I generally just wear horse blinders to what other people think of me or think is happening with me. And I think that probably came from being a super masculine female, you know, and sort of toughening of my emotional skin of what I looked like in the world and how I presented. So people trying to figure out who I was and what my gender was before I even knew what my gender was, you know, from kids, you know, tugging on their parents' arms and, you know, mommy, is that a boy or a girl? Like every day of my life from 18 to 40, pretty much. So I had that not just in the general community, but I had that the moment that I would be walking to a stage to tell jokes, to do a set. I remember, it's funny, I had this one experience when I was first starting stand-up back in Maine at this club, and I was doing pretty well there. And I was going up, was pretty jazzed, and I heard this guy as I was walking, he saw me, and I heard him say something like effing dyke or something like that, right as I was walking to the stage. And I'm very open about this, but I had a very large chest, but I had very short hair. It was very clear who I was before I hit the stage. If I were to get up there and say I had a boyfriend, people would know that I was lying, you know? So I knew this guy had made sort of this massive prejudgment before I even got to the stage, but I was prepared for that. Like from my experience, like before I ever took the stage as a comic, I knew these people. And I just thought, I'm going to make that guy laugh. I'm going to get him. And so I found that my way in was to get people's shoulders down from their ears and relax them into who I was by sharing my story and making it funny.
I do believe that both of you are making an incredible difference by sharing your stories. You are the truest sense of a successful actor and beautiful human beings to share your stories, truly. So I have to say thank you. And before we go, I also want to say thank you to the SAG-AFTRA National LGBTQ Committee for their ongoing work regarding representation and inclusion.
On the 13th of November, 1970, South Korean garment worker Chun Tae-il, after trying to organize for better conditions, poured kerosene on his body and set himself on fire in front of Seoul's Peace Market. After his death, his mother, Lee So-sun, dedicated her life to continuing his work, organizing amongst garment workers under the brutal US-backed military dictatorship. This is Working Class History. Hi, and welcome back to the Working Class History Podcast, which is brought to you by our Patreon supporters. Today's the first of several episodes we have planned on Korean history. Specifically, we're going to be looking at struggles in the South Korean garment industry, and in particular at the lives of Chun Tae-il and Lee So-sun, two really central figures in the workers' movement, one of whom is very well known in South Korea, and one of whom is not so well known, for reasons we'll explore later. We are very pleased to be joined by Rachel Min Park, a member of the Hearn Coalition.
Chun Tae-il was born September 28, 1948, in Daegu, Gyeongsang Province, as the oldest of two sons and two daughters. He was the eldest son of Chun Sang-soo, a poor laborer and tailor from Daegu, and his wife, Lee So-sun, whose father had been an independence fighter during the colonial period and had been killed by the Japanese authorities. At the age of 13, Lee So-sun had been taken by Japanese authorities as part of their forced labor program and worked in a factory that manufactured uniforms. So he came from a very poor, underprivileged family background, but this was also sadly a rather common background during these times. Chun Tae-il, so the anti-communism of the Cold War and suppression of labor rights started to kind of merge in this immediate post-war period. And then what this meant in the labor sphere specifically was that there were two strands of trade unionism in Korea at the time. One was represented by the Federation of Korean Trade Unions, or FKTU, which is the kind of like national umbrella organization for all unions. But their leaders were always appointed either directly by the military government or by the managers of individual companies. So not very sympathetic to the plight of everyday workers. And then the other strand in Korean labor unionism at the time was the Democratic Trade Union Movement. So the more informal, unofficial, and kind of grassroots movements that consisted of mainly branch unions in textiles, electronics, and the garment sectors. So the proportion of women in the labor force kept increasing across the decade. So around 29% in 1960, 35% in 1970, and then 37% approximately in 1980. For women, they mostly worked in agricultural production, industrial manufacturing, but they were excluded from the most capital-intensive industries, such as shipbuilding, chemical and automobiles, and they didn't have any access to vocational training. Holding education levels constant, women workers in manufacturing received about 56% of the wages paid to their male counterparts. And these young women migrants then just became a part of this rising proletariat class in South Korea's industrializing economy. And they created an easy and kind of abundant supply of cheap and exploitable industrial labor.
So this is the general situation Chun Tae-il found himself in as he began his working life. South Korea, like the North, was a very, quote, underdeveloped country at this point. And so the government wanted to rapidly industrialize to grow the economy at the expense of super exploited industrial workers who could be crushed by the military dictatorship if they complained.
So when he was in Seoul, Jun did a variety of work, peddling newspapers, polishing shoes, and so on. And then he finally started to work as a sewing assistant at the Seoul Pyeonghwa Shijang, or the Seoul Peace Market, with the sewing skills that he had learned from his father. And then when he turned 17, he was promoted to a shida, or a helper of the sewing machinists and garment cutters at the sweatshops there. I think also perhaps this is revealing of Jung's character and what he was like, is that there are a lot of stories that mention how he spent most of his wages, a pittance anyways, but he would spend most of his wages either helping out his family, taking care of his younger siblings, but then also later on when he was at the sweatshop, he spent a significant amount of money just trying to help the poor young woman workers there with things like buying them medicine, buying them food. And so I think in a way, though he was so young, we have a really good glimpse of what kind of person he was.
A Christian, Jun often spent his bus fare on food for his colleagues who worked through their lunch breaks hungry, and instead walked his 3-hour journey back home on foot. Sometimes on the way, he'd get caught by military curfews and have to spend the night sleeping at a police station. But he came to realise that individual acts of generosity like this weren't enough. Seeing the extreme suffering of those he worked with, mostly young girls, he made a resolution.
In this horrible world, where human beings are stripped of all that is human, I will never compromise with any iniquity. I will not remain silent before any injustice, but pay heed and work to rectify it.
Theme music for this episode was Marching for the Beloved, about the Gwangju Uprising, by Beek Ki Wang, Hwang Suk Young, and Kim Jong Ryul. Link to stream it in the show notes. Thanks to Jesse French for editing this episode. And finally, thanks to you for listening. Catch you next time.
That's it for this edition of the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, our roundup of highlights from some of the more than 100 Labor Radio shows and podcasts that make up the Labor Radio Podcast Network. We've got links to all the network shows at laborradionetwork.org, including complete versions of the shows you heard today. You can also find them by using the hashtag LaborRadioPod on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Labor Radio Podcast Weekly was edited by Patrick Dixon and Chris Banger-Drowns, produced by me, and our social media guru, as always, is Harold Phillips. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Labor Radio Net. Find out more on our website at laborradionetwork.org. Check out our live stream show available at Labor Radio Net on Facebook and Labor Radio Podcast Network YouTube, where you'll also find profiles of members of the network. For Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, this is Chris Garlock urging you to stay active and, of course, stay tuned to your local Labor Radio Podcast show.